So here's where we are. Democratic House lawmakers are undertaking an impeachment inquiry. Republicans are pushing for them to move to a full vote on impeachment, in part to get Democrats in vulnerable red districts on the record. But as Democrats juggle a possible impeachment with a looming election, our next guest says don't assume all those people in red districts, especially rural red districts, are Trump supporters. Sarah Smart has long taken on the media for what she says is a false narrative that every white working-class rural person is a Trump supporter with grease on his jeans. In fact, 2016 primary exit polls showed that Trump voters were more affluent than most Americans, a median household income of $72,000. 44% of them had college degrees, well above the national average. And Sarah quotes the political scientist Matthew McWilliams, who concluded that a penchant for authoritarianism, not income or education, predicted a Trump voter. Sarah Smarsh was born and raised outside Wichita, Kansas. Her 2018 book is Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. She's a frequent op-ed columnist. And Sarah, as part of your reasoning, you've pointed to your own grandmother, who I'm hoping she's still with us.
She is.
Great.
Thank you.
So she'd be 73-year-old Betty. You know, here she is on bad knees from factory lines, smoking-induced emphysema, false teeth she's had since her 20s, hates Donald Trump.
Yeah. And, you know, it boggles my mind that those identity markers of her would make her immediately presumed as a Trump voter. We sort of have this image, you know, of the economically distressed white person. And really what's gone on among, you know, Trump voters is not poor whiteness, but rather just whiteness. To speak to my grandmother's politics, no one loathes the current president more than she does in 2016 because of laws that made it harder to vote. She, like many people, stood in line at the Kansas caucus for 3 hours in order to show up for a Democratic socialist named Bernie Sanders, who had more votes in the primary in Kansas than Donald Trump. And that was true in a lot of states that Trump ended up winning in the general. So these conversations are much more nuanced than the reductive headlines indicate.
Well, I remember going to the first caucus in Iowa and, you know, calling back in and saying, guys, I'm meeting young men in particular who are trying to decide between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump because they saw them both as disruptors. In other words,
right. Yeah, that's exactly right. I think what a lot of us knew during that election and some folks in perhaps more powerful places didn't understand is that would indeed be a change election. I don't think that energy has dissolved by any means. And it was a populist moment. It remains so. And it was a matter of in which direction would that energy be leveraged. And I think there was great potential and remains for it to be leveraged in the direction of the left.
What are you seeing? I mean, are you seeing still support for Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, who has many of the same policies? What are you seeing?
Well, I would say that about six of the current Democratic candidates now have a very robust, comprehensive rural platform. I've been quite heartened to see that. It's more attention paid to that space than I've ever witnessed in my just shy of 40 years. And, you know, that's no doubt for political calculations, but I think also because there are some progressive candidates who deeply understand their sort of baseline tactics, which is to go at wealth inequality and economic injustice, you know, track very perfectly with the ways in which family farms and rural people have been on the losing end of policy for many decades. And so it's quite a natural thing for someone like Warren or Sanders to hit the right mark in terms of talking about rural. So these platforms, they're talking about access to broadband, healthcare access, which is a veritable crisis right now, particularly in non-Medicaid expansion states, economic development, of course, climate change, trade reform, perhaps even making rural America by way of investment a steward of a Green New Deal. So I've definitely seen a shift in energy toward Warren. Also a lot of respect for Klobuchar, Buttigieg, folks who indicate with their policy notions a real understanding of rural spaces. But But yeah, as far as what's on the ground right now, what do I see? Rural America is a diverse place, and that's true of anywhere. So I could never speak for the whole. I do know that what I see on the ground is something different than the one-dimensional headlines usually portray.
And let's talk about those headlines, because you explain why you think they happen, and I think it's pretty sharp. You say that Democrats or the media who are trying to explain why Trump won assume it's because of bigotry, because he plays on issues like race, like immigration. And therefore, if they think it's bigotry, they equate bigotry with poor white rural people, which is, in fact, a huge insult. You know, we take your point. You know, anybody who's been here on the East Coast to a wealthy enclave, let's say on Long Island, where I grew up, you know how much Trump support there is among very wealthy people who maybe don't want to lose what they have. But this notion that the media has the numbers wrong, how do you square that with the fact that polls show that something like 60% of rural voters are still supporting President Trump?
I'm not disputing the numbers, but the story that the numbers tell, the way that it's framed sometimes, is misleading, I think. And, you know, as far as bigotry, I want to be clear that I think that actually is a greater propulsion behind his supporters than is, quote unquote, economic distress. And that's for precisely, you know, to your point, the affluent voters in the Northeast who are white came out for him in droves, too. And they certainly weren't, quote unquote, voting against their best interest. So again, it's not poor whiteness that correlates with supporting Trump or rural whiteness, but rather just simply whiteness. And that inherent in that could very well, in many cases, be an overt bigotry. It's at the very least a racial privilege that allows them to overlook the ways in which he's dangerous to people of color.
Talk about tone. J.D. Scholten, who nearly beat GOP Rep. Steve King in Iowa last year, recently made the comment that the Democratic Party is starting to look too much like the Whole Foods Party, elitist. If you could just share a little of your view of this. You grew up on a family farm outside Wichita, worked as a young person at a grain elevator. Really dangerous places. If too much gases get in there, they can explode. They did. 7 people were killed. Here you are, somebody who liked to watch Bill Maher at night, you know, after you finished your work at the grain elevator, and you turn it on, and he makes a horribly crude remark about these lost workers. They still haven't found the bodies. And he says something about, you know, be careful with your loaf of bread. I mean, appalling. And I'm just, you know, you as a young person offering yourself up as somebody open to, you know, more liberal thinking. Describe that moment for you.
Yeah, it stuck with me, and it is always sort of my touchstone. It hurt. It cut to the core of me. I should say it wasn't my elevator where that explosion happened. It was a few miles down the road. But I was one of the people putting on a hard hat and helping in the production of the bread that he would sit in some office in Los Angeles or New York City and eat on a sandwich for lunch, and yet so easily dismiss those very workers. So, you know, I now wear my politics on my sleeve as a commentator. I identify as a progressive, but yet I can understand the sense of resentment that someone might have if they feel that one side of the aisle has forgotten or dismissed. Meanwhile, you've got the decades of Democrats perhaps not paying the attention that they should have to that space. But concurrent with that was the right very artfully leveraging what I would call just sort of the cultural markers of that space. When I was a kid, country music, pickup trucks, the American flag were not correlated with a particular party. They were just part of our lives, and they had no sort of tribal political identity. Mm. Those things have very intentionally been leveraged by one side to say, this is our brand. And then there becomes, for people who need a sense of pride about where they come from when every iteration of them in popular culture is derisive and pejorative, it then becomes a way to feel like, okay, we've got a team and we have somebody who sees us. I'm not saying that this, you know, from my vantage of bias, forgives anyone for overlooking what I see as the very dangerous aspects of the Trump presidency, but it does go a long way in explaining what's going on psychologically.
Sarah Smarsh from outside Wichita, Kansas, We've been checking in with her on how rural voters are feeling in the heartland. She wrote a whole book about it in 2018 called Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
And as always, your thoughts welcome, hereandnow.org.